now it's time for our workshop, the intimacy, the real elephant in the room, and I give you Judy Kay.
Hi, everyone. I'm Judy, very grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of the Al-Anon Family Groups, which includes Alateen. And if I met you this morning, thank you for your kind words and introducing yourselves. I feel like I'm a native, except for my language. Somebody told me I had a northern accent. Can you believe that? And my husband said, no, you're just speaking right. And I thought, okay, but it's really fun to hear all the varieties in people's voices and just to meet people and share a little snippet of your own experience. Well, in my experience, what I discovered, I always thought a workshop was where people got together at tables and they chit-chatted and shared and solved problems of the world, and then they rotated and talked to somebody else and had questions and answered. And then I came to Al-Anon and events, and they'd say, well, it's a workshop. So I would go in prepared, thinking, boy, I get to share my opinion when this comes up. And it was never asked for. There would be a speaker sharing on a topic, and that was considered a workshop. So, you know, I've been to many of those, and that's been the format, at least where I've been. So I sort of planned for that. Well, not sort of. I did plan for that. And then I came in here, and I met Mike last night, and he said, well, how do you want to do the Q&A? I went, what? Q&A? And I thought, well, somebody's more progressive in this area than I've experienced. And I thought, well, that's a good idea. I, you know, hadn't entertained that idea, but we're an intimate group, and I thought, you know, why not? We can do that. So Rick does have a mic, and if somebody will have, there he is, hand in the air, and he's ready to come out if someone has a question. I want to warn you, though, I have no answers. None, but you can ask. I only share my experience and based on Al-Anon principles and program principles. So I think I'll pause at certain points. So, you know, we won't have questions all over the place because I will lose my way. And I had great fun thinking about this topic, reading on it, making notes, letting it go, coming back to it, and I really learned a lot. I have to tell you, in 2019, I was invited up to Oregon, and I was asked if I would share my story and do a workshop. Workshop topic to be determined. I said, fine, sure. So then they got back to me, and they said, well, we've decided on a topic. It's intimacy. And I said to myself, well, crap. I don't like that topic. I don't want to do it. Well, you know what? COVID came. It was postponed. And good. And then it was postponed a second year. Third year coming, I sent them their ticket money back and said, I'm sure you can use this, and I'll use my airline credits. I never had to do it. So I talked to Lisa, and she said, we'd like a workshop. And she said, you can decide. And I looked again at topics and wrote down a few. And you know what I thought the best topic was? Intimacy. They decided that in Oregon several years ago because that's what the fellowship wanted. And you know, that was hard for me initially. I had kind of a 1970s response. I'm not talking about that. I mean, after all, I grew up in Minnesota. We're pretty rigid up there, Scandinavians. You know, the most intimate we get when we say goodbye is to honk the horn on the car when you leave the driveway. That means, I love you, beep, beep. That's it. You know, there's not a lot of hugging, not a lot of stuff like that. So I've had to learn that closeness here. But it is the topic. And I think, you know, you wonder maybe why I called it the real elephant in the living room. And that's just a phrase from Al-Anon's last and latest book, Intimacy in Alcoholic Relationships. And someone refers to it as that. And, well, why? Well, I started scanning our literature and our books, looking at intimacy from 1951, kind of on up. And intimacy was referred to as the sex problem. Yeah, 1951. But since 1951, Al-Anon has really published over 100 pamphlets and books, and we as a fellowship have grown, which now includes, we have many Al-Anon members who are also members of Alcoholics Anonymous, affected by the disease, and our fellowship has changed and expanded and grown in depth, I think, of diversity and also understanding. And so sort of my plan today was to just run through a little bit to show you how some of our literature and attitudes have changed in the literature. Address a couple foundational barriers that I think are generally obstacles to intimacy for us all. And then to pick out three topics that really do cover, I think, aspects of intimacy. And these are the big topics that are addressed in this book. You know, and what is intimacy? In an Al-Anon definition, it's pretty simple. It's feeling close to, feeling a part of, not apart from, and safe. And when I'm intimate, I'm feeling cozy. I'm not feeling threatened. And I guess that's the great value of a home group. You know, when I'm there, I'm comfortable. And initially when I came to Al-Anon, for that 1 hour, I felt safe. I was so tired of active alcoholism. It's like a tornado through the living room. And it was intimate. And somebody said, come sit by me. Share a chair. You want some coffee? Oh, God, I did. I just wanted to sit and be still. So to me, that's it. It doesn't sound complicated, intimacy, to be close, to be comfortable. But it is. So I started, and here's a little quick overview of some of our Cal. Our first book, in fact, even our titles have changed, which I find really interesting. 1954, Living with an Alcoholic. Doesn't that sound kind of dismal for a title? You got to live with it. And there was a page and a half in there about the sex problem. And it was all from the point of view of wives of alcoholics. Because, and even when I came in, everybody in Al-Anon basically had a spouse that was in AA. It was a couple thing. You know, that was it. And by the time I was living in Reno serving the fellowship, I looked around the room once at a district meeting. There was only one person, one group representative, who actually had a spouse in AA. The rest of the people were Al-Anon members with maybe a child, a parent, a sibling. You know, we've changed so much. But in 1954, the comment was, it's a sex problem, it's hard to talk about, and seek professional help. That was about it. 1976, our first four-step book came out. It was a small booklet, The Blueprint for Progress. Nothing about sex or intimacy in there. There was a little paragraph about love. 1984, that book in 1954, 30 years later, we changed the topic. It's no longer titled Living with an Alcoholic. It is now titled Al-Anon Family Groups. But there's still that page and a quarter about the sex problem. There's no content change, but the title has changed. 1989, we really stepped out. The 80s, Al-Anon is really coming of age. We have another title, Dilemma of the Alcoholic Marriage. Dilemma. But you know what? That's a pretty good book. And boy, I can tell you, I was reading it. The title was attractive to me. There's a little in there, and I was going to bring the book, but you know, it's so stiff. The language is so archaic. Talks about the man's libido and the prowess, and you know, oh my God, you know. I'm not reading that. You know, it's pretty right on. So if you're interested in the sex problem, that book does have a chapter and 20 pages, and I understand it's going to be republished, I think, with a preface, keeping the content, but saying that, you know, the language is a little dated, but you know, the sex problem never changes. So there's a whole chapter there. But in 2004, now we're coming into the 2000s, the Blueprint for Progress has been expanded. That's the four-step inventory book for Al-Anon. And it's very long. In fact, I remember my home group took a bunch of these new four-step books to the prison. I used to go to a prison meeting down in Carson City near where I lived, and Al was the guy who had the key to the room and good AA member and would let me in. And I was all excited that we got to bring those four-step books to Al and the friends there. And I said, Al, what do you think of the blueprint? Isn't it great? And he looked at it and he paged and he goes, oh my God, 94 pages. I'm not in for life. But in that book, love is in there, sex is in there, and so is intimacy. Those are each a chapter. So by 2004, we're coming more of age and acknowledging there's more to intimacy than sex. Isn't that something? So there, if you, where I meet my home group, we also have AA and LA team. And I would have to say that a number of AA members come down the hall and ask to look in our literature box and, you know, see if they can get some of our stuff, and we share willingly. So it's a good four-step book, chapter by chapter. 2008, a book came out called Discovering Choices, Our Recovery in Relationships, and this is all about relationships. The next workshop, it'll be the same thing, different voices, because we're all working for that same thing, to feel close, to feel comfortable, to feel connected, that spiritual connection, because we're human beings. And Discovering Choices takes a new look. It's just a collection of personal stories. People share their experience. That other one, Dilemma of the Alcoholic Marriage, somebody is really preachy in that book. And then they have an AA member sharing his view in that book, which is really surprising. It's Al-Anon literature. But it's like, you know, she does this and he says this. But that is out the door in 2008, because it's simply members willing to talk about intimate experiences and thoughts and feelings. And they're simply stories. Nobody's, you know, giving any judgment or evaluation. And then we come along to 2018. And finally, after all these years from 1951, comes a book about intimacy. And the funny thing is, and it's mentioned in the preface, that members have wanted this book and its contents for years. But because our literature comes from members only, it's not written by outside people, members never shared. So we wanted it, but we weren't willing to give up our experiences. It's too private. and it's too embarrassing or whatever. And it took several years, but finally 1,300 members shared their experiences, some of them quite real, quite things you could relate to, and they were compiled into this book. But it's interesting. We want it, but we don't want to help out by producing something, you know, but we have it today. So we've gone from avoiding the topic to calling it simply sex to saying maybe there's more to it than that. And our literature really reflects that. And if you haven't seen this book, and anybody, you can get it online at the Al-Anon online store. I don't even remember how much it was, but the topics that it addresses in here are the ones that I thought we could address today. And there are three. The first one is trust, which is critical for intimacy. The second one is communication. And the third one is boundaries. And all of the stories relate to those three topics. And I think they're relevant to being alive and whatever fellowship you're in, because we're all people and they all fit. So first of all, before we get to trust, I wanted to just touch on, I think there are foundational barriers to any of those. And there are three. And the first one is past experiences, especially as childhood. There's a lot of hurt, I think, that people come in with growing up, perhaps. It could be sexual abuse. It just could be violence. It could be being ignored. It could be one of many, never listened to. The list goes on when people share those things. And I know I have a friend. She was my best friend in high school. And her father was alcoholic, which, you know, I never realized until I got into the program. We just knew he was really controlling and thought he knew everything. But she was a little overweight, and she lived on a river. And he used to make her row the rowboat because it would help her lose weight. And it was so demeaning to her, and she hated to row. But I can remember we would come home, and he would say, "Chris, have you gone rowing yet today?" "No, Dad." "Get down to the river." And, you know, I would wait for her, and she would have to go down and get in that dumb rowboat, get those oars, and row. He thought it would be good for her, help her lose weight. She hates exercise, she hates water, and she basically hated her dad, you know, for something simple like that. You hear those little stories from the past. But I have learned the past does not have to define the future, but you do have to take a look at it. You know, what is it in the past that's holding you up, but it's still not letting you go forward? I think I have a lot of friends who, you know, because of relationships with their father, don't trust men. And that's hard. So past experiences as a child, that's one. The second one is present experiences, current, right now. And for me, that's easy. There are two categories. It's either you're living with active alcoholism or you're in recovery. And if you're living in active alcoholism, there are so many difficulties. I think of our difficulties. I mean, they're endless. The distorted thinking, you know, the silent treatment, nobody speaking. But if you even get in recovery, maybe nobody's still speaking. It's quiet. I sponsor Alateen, and there was one boy not long ago, he said, "You know, my brother and I used to be so close. And then when he came home from rehab, I don't know what to say to him. He said, we're just not talking." And I thought, yeah, I can get that. I understand that. Or if you're in a new relationship, which might be part of recovery, that's difficult too. You know, How much do you share? I remember when I met Herb in a new relationship, and he put out his hand to hold my hand, and I really thought I would throw up. I was so upset by that. You know, I think, oh, my God. It was too intimate. But it got worse. Or better. So past experiences as a kid, adult experiences, and then the third one is simply, and this is talked about a lot in our intimacy book, character traits, those defects that are tied up with our attitudes. And personally, I have a lot of them. I had some fears, a lot of resentments, a lot of stubbornness, unwillingness. I'm not going to be first. I'm not going to apologize. I didn't do it. Not my fault. He did it. Stuff like that. You know, that's really helpful, isn't it, when you get into all that stuff. And I like the classic one that people often say, that's the way I am. That's just me. And I have found here you can be somebody completely new and likable and wonderful. You can grow. But you got to acknowledge those attitudes. My dad used to say, believe nothing what you hear and half of what you see. That was his attitude. And he was pretty stoic. He only smiled about once a decade. And if he laughed out loud, you know, it went on record. That was my dad. I learned to hug him in Al-Anon before he passed away. And actually, it was the night he passed away. I was finally able to say, I love you, Dad. Just once, that's all I got out. It took me years. But he couldn't say anything even on the other end except, goodbye, Jude. But I knew he loved me. But we just simply didn't go there. And it's so nice to hear somebody say, I love you. You know, it can be rare. So those barriers, but we can get over those barriers. And it's real clear in our literature. It says discovering how to achieve and maintain intimacy in every aspect of our lives is crucial to recovery. If we cannot feel like we are a part of instead of apart from, we may never leave the feelings of isolation that have such a debilitating effect of the disease of alcoholism. And it is debilitating. It's horrible to feel lonely. Lisa sent me a message and said, do you want to eat dinner Friday night or do you want to have breakfast today? Welcome. You know, experience our Southern hospitality. And I thought, I'm going for dinner because when I get here, I want to get connected right away so I don't feel apart from. Because it's really lonely to go to an event and somebody thinks, oh, she's the speaker. Whoa, I don't know if I'm going to talk to her. You know, she's up there. And it can be the loneliest place in the world. And you come from a loving fellowship and you think, I just want to jump in and be with you. And so it's been really nice. We had dinner with Sean and Lisa and, you know, we're sharing. And we ended up talking about the first fight we ever had as being married people. I shared mine. They shared theirs. I don't know how it happened, but you see, I felt intimate by the time I got into the meeting. I go, I'm home. You know, it's so important. So we're going to take a look at trust first. And at this point, I'll stop. If anyone has a question or you'd like to make a comment, Rick's got the mic. And if you want to share anything, or ask me something. Like I said, I have no answers, but I'm open to anyone. Okay, well, let's hop into trust. Trust. Our chapter talks about building and rebuilding. I think it's harder to rebuild than to build myself. You know, once it's lost. But what is it? What is it? For me, trusting a person means, again, to feel safe. Even vulnerable. I must have trusted Lisa and Sean. I told them something that only Herb and I really know, you know, because we were in the program. And I think trust includes knowing that you're not going to be violated or hurt by somebody, it's going to be okay. And even a little more that they want the best for you. They're in your corner. They're cheering for you. And that's why it's never really very scary sharing in an Al-Anon event like this, because I look out and I know that you want me to succeed. And I want you to have a wonderful experience. And we're all in it together. And that's intimacy. But some of the synonyms for trust: honest, reliable, trustworthy, consistent, faithful, respectful. And there are horrible barriers to trust. In active alcoholism, there's lying. And on both sides, when I say this, I'm not talking about the alcoholic. There's lying on my part. There's manipulation. There's dishonesty. I kept my parents in the dark about what was happening. You know, my husband had another car accident. I said something about the car. I blamed the car. Infidelity. That's a biggie if that happens in a relationship. A lot of violations of trust. And I always thought it was the alcoholic that was off having an affair. And shoot, I think I have 3 good friends in Al-Anon. I learned way down the road they were having affairs on the side. They didn't know what to do in their marital relationship, and so they stepped out looking other places, you know, for satisfaction and comfort. And I was shocked. I'm going, really? You're in Al-Anon. What are you doing? You know? But, you know, I might have done it myself, but I got involved in service. I mean, I distinctly know that that is what keeps you from going out there and doing more stupid stuff. I do. Because I remember there was a very attractive young math teacher, you know, where I worked. And I, you know, he was looking pretty good. And somebody called me that night and wanted me to go up to MHI, the Mental Health Institute, and share our stories and take some literature. I chose MHI, you know, because I was learning about the principles of the program, but you couldn't have trusted me either, basically. And then in recovery, there's a new set of trust issues. You hear all the time about, you know, Al-Anon people sometimes being jealous of a spouse going off to AA. And then these lovely AA women. I mean, I've always thought I looked like Betty Crocker. And then I see some of these beautiful women coming to an AA function. I go, man, I feel like a frump. You know, they've got a nice sexy black dress on and hair looks great and little jewelry and high heels. And here I am in my flats. And, you know, I should just go home and make a casserole. I mean, you know, you get those twinges. And it's easy to compare and get a little jealous and then fearful. And I know for me, I kept bringing up the past. I just couldn't let the past go. So, you know, I needed to get into forgiveness, but those are horrible barriers to trust. So these were some questions that I thought I'd just throw out. There are 4 of them. And since I was thinking we wouldn't get to talk, I was the only one who had to talk, but you're welcome to talk. That was Mike's idea. Somebody to be trustworthy to me has to keep their word. So this is a question I have for you. How well do you keep your word to others? And how well do you keep the promises you've made to yourself? Do you associate with trustworthy people? You hear an Al-Anon all the time about their pickers being broken. And what qualities in people make them worthy of your trust? And these are questions that I certainly had to think about in my 4th and 5th step. Do I keep my word? Do I keep promises I made to myself? That's the hard one. And that gets into our last topic, boundaries. Because I would say, I'm never going to do that again. And then I'd do it one more time. And today, I think when I am thinking about being trustworthy, I'm thinking about being honest. No secrets. I know I have a friend who always shops, and then she hides her stuff in the trunk, and then she takes it in when Jim's not home. I don't think that's real honest. So I know if I shop, the bag is open, and usually we have a fashion show because it's very rarely I shop, but it's up front. I'm reliable. If I say I'm coming home, I come home. I don't cancel or make a promise I can't keep. But something that really goes into trust for me is respect. Privacy, keeping confidentialities. I would have to say when I was first in the program, some of the stories that alcoholics tell are really funny. You know, I mean, they're tragic. But they're funny from the podium when you're not having it happen to you. And I used to think that was amusing and funny, and I remember when I would share, I might bring up something the alcoholic did that was kind of funny or pathetic or, you know, whatever. And I had been invited to go to Waterloo, a town north of where I lived, and share my experience. And I was thinking, you know, a few funny things. It came down to shortly before I was to go, and my husband said to me, if you go to Waterloo, I'm going to throw your things out on the deck. You know, and you can pick them up when you come home. And I wondered why he would say that. And he said, well, it's really not an anonymous program because I ordered a tape and I listened to what you said, and I wasn't happy with it, so out on the deck. Well, you know, I lived in Iowa. The winter's kind of chilly. And I had to think about that, and the more I thought about it, I thought, you know, truly he's right. I mean, his behavior is not my story. And although it's funny, it could be humiliating to him. It could be embarrassing. And I had notes, of course, so I remember going in the back room feeling very conflicted because I'd made a commitment. But I looked at my notes, and I revised my notes. I cut out everything, you know, that was kind of amusing or whatever, and put the focus on me. And that was a very good lesson for me from him, because Al-Anon is about keeping the focus on me, and it's not telling his story. And after I heard people in recovery sharing their story, they're not pleased about their behavior. I mean, it's nothing that you want to laugh about deep down. And I decided to go to Waterloo. And I said before I went to Waterloo, I said, I have looked at my notes. I have kept the focus on me, and I've decided to go, and it's your choice if you want to put my things out on the deck. But I have to go because I made the commitment. And I went, had a decent time. I did have one glitch. I ordered breakfast in my room because I was so happy to be there. And, you know, breakfast in bed, I mean, my gosh, that's what you see in the movies. And I ordered breakfast, and I followed the rules. It said on there, put your tray out in the hallway. And it was sort of an alcove, and I was in my underwear, and I leaned out with my tray, but I needed to get a little further out so they could see it coming by. And I leaned out, and the door locked behind me. And there I was, downtown Waterloo, in my underwear in the Holiday Inn. Problem or opportunity? I thought I'll have some clothes on the deck, you know. And fortunately, the Alateen member was... We had had a conversation that night at the dance, and she asked, you know, where I was staying, and I told her my room number, and I remembered hers, and I duck and cover. And then I got down to her room and knocked on the door and I said, let me in. And they didn't want to let me in because there was a person out there in the underwear, but I said, it's me, remember? And they let me in and I called the desk. The guy said, oh, come on down and get your key. I go, well, I think I'll send someone. And, you know, so after that incident, I had to laugh. You know, I had let go. It had lightened up and I thought, whatever. And of course I went home and, you know, my clothes weren't on the deck. I was let back in. So, but that changed, my focus. Respecting the alcoholic is critical, I think. And then learning to have love and compassion and, just to be kind. So this trust, even remarrying for me, how much could I trust? Today I think I kind of trust the science. As you hear in the news, you have to see the facts and hear the facts and see the facts demonstrated. And when people are trustworthy, then it's easy to trust. And every once in a while, my sister and I will chat and she'll say, you know, you're lucky or something. And she'll say, your husband is an honorable person. And I will say, you know, he has integrity. I trust him. And that's such a wonderful thing to be able to say about a person. I don't know what you could say that's better. So how do I become trustworthy myself? For me, it was the fourth and fifth step. You know, you really got to look at those things from the past and those behaviors that are current that aren't serving you well. Because I'm not going to be close to somebody I don't trust. I don't even tell them much. And I used to tell everybody everything. But I think to be discerning is to be smart about trust. Sometimes I think you have to act as if. I mean, I act as if, but I'm careful because I'm thoughtful about what I'm sharing and where it's going. And that makes all the difference. I think the best thing about learning trust has to deal with being sponsored. I remember a lady coming to my home group and we were talking about sponsorship that night. And she said, I could never have a sponsor. And I'm thinking, well, you can never have recovery, woman. But, you know, people were kind of intrigued by that. She said, no, I could never tell people about my life. I just wouldn't do it. Well, you know, I have discovered since I have told somebody about my life, there has been nothing about my behavior that has shocked my sponsor. She just, you know, let's move on, honey. You know, another. I mean, we're human and we make mistakes and we make errors and we make bad decisions and hopefully in recovery we learn from them and we move forward. That's been the process for me. So today I don't think people lie to me. And if they do lie to me, I let them know I think I'm being lied to. You know, I don't say, you liar. But I say, I feel I'm not being told the truth. And I can't respect that. I never trusted myself. I don't know how many times I would say to myself, I should have trusted my instincts. Today, I think my instincts are my higher power, guiding me on a reasonable course. But it's so easy to take the easy way, you know? And I drifted. Today, I think I trust myself. I trust the right people because I pick better choices for the people I hang out with. I sponsored a woman and we met one time and she goes, oh my God, I was dancing last night. There was a guy with a gun. And I said, what are you doing? You know, dancing somewhere where it sounds dangerous. And she said, oh, well, I love to dance. I'm thinking, well, your choice of environment isn't the best, you know, but where do you hang out? Where do you hang out? And then eventually, you know, that higher power. We heard a little last night about the God of grace. I didn't have a higher power. And I figured if there was one, he was a man. And I wasn't trusting a man. Not after my experience, but higher power is bigger than a man. And I have a friend who says, if your higher power isn't big enough, get a bigger one. You know, you have a choice. So, trust is critical. I'm close to you if I trust you, and you're close to me if you trust me. That's part of being intimate. Okay, let me stop. Would anyone like to throw out a question or a comment about trust? Maybe things that have come to mind as I've shared? There's one way in the back, and there's one here, my Rick. The lady with the hat.
Hi, I'm Avery. I'm an alcoholic. And, what was coming to mind as you talked about trust, I was sharing with one of my friends about how my husband and I were friends before we got married. And it wasn't planned that way. And we were friends for 4 years. And I never expected to have a relationship with him. So as a result of that, since we were good friends, I told him everything about me. And when we started to date, I felt uncomfortable with that. Because now he knew everything about me. And so what happened is, at one point I noticed in our relationship, he started to kind of hold back some. And I asked him why, and he said, because of some of the things I know about you, I don't trust you. You know? And then I thought about all the things that I had told him about my past behavior, and it was when I was, well, out of early sobriety, and I thought, at first I got very angry. And then I thought about it, and I said, well, he's not accusing me of anything I'm not capable of. I'm just not practicing today. And I was able to not have, you know, the anger I had toward him. And as a result, I grew from that. And he grew to trust me because I earned the trust because of the experience he's had with me going in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He knew he could trust me. And, you know, my husband ended up having dementia, and he entrusted me with his life. And I'm just really grateful for that. I was sharing with somebody outside that the fact that we were friends first made a big difference, because I would have normally held back and tried to pretend to be somebody else. But I'm really grateful that he knew me, because he created intimacy. And not only that, during the time he had dementia, he even forgot at one point that we were married, but he always remembered my name and that we were friends. Thank you.
Thanks, Avery. That's funny. That reminds me, Herb and I were just talking maybe a couple days ago, because he's not in the program. I was always in the program. He initially never came with me, and the first time he came with me to an event, I said to him just a few days ago, I was so nervous. I just talk like an idiot, I think. I was so aware of him out there. And he said, why were you nervous? And I said, well, it was so personal. And he kind of looked at me like, well, you know, we're married. But I hadn't shared this side of me before, so I really understand that. A question in the back.
Yeah, I'm Thomas, and I'm part of the Al-Anon and AA family. how do you gain trust and give trust when someone is lying to you about their drinking?
Well, like I said, I have no answers. The only thing that, for me, was living with active alcoholism, I basically didn't trust even what I saw, because I knew that that went along with alcoholism. So if I was being lied to, I simply accepted it as a lie and as part of the illness and moved on with my life. And that was it. Lies can be a daily occurrence from either side of the aisle, sadly. I mean, I remember a lady taking exception. I said, well, I don't have any expectations of an active alcoholic. And she said, oh, yes, you have to. And I go, well, you can if you want to. But it hasn't served me well. Yeah, you know. Okay. Okay, Mark had one. And one up here. Yeah, those are good questions.
Hi, Mark. I'm on call.
Hey, Mark. Hello.
You mentioned you changed a lot of your mean behavior, so to speak, with changes to kindness. And I wondered if you struggle with the line between kindness and enabling.
That is also a good question. And I think the difference is for enabling is that you can be kind without doing for somebody what they should do for themselves. That's enabling. You know, I can still lovingly say, it's your car. I guess you'll have to take it in and get the oil changed. I'm doing mine. But I'm not taking your vehicle in because you're busy drinking. But you're right. That's a hard one. Did you have a question up here?
Sure.
Rick, you want the mic so everyone can...
Thank you so much.
Then everybody can hear you if you've got the mic.
I'm Marshall, an alcoholic. So it's so delightful to listen to you talk and your humor and stuff. I really appreciate it. I mean, I laugh at anything, often it does. But I recently learned a little lesson. I was in a state of disturbance with my partner and couldn't see my part. But I talked to a guy in AA after a meeting and helped me see the two defects of character, which come up all the time. You know, they're controlling and critical. But he also helped me see a third thing, which is I was taught after I finally did a fourth step to practice transparency, at least among AA guys. But I was also sort of demanding transparency of others, right? And he says, I do not have a right to demand transparency of my partner or other people. So I'm kind of interested in your perspective on that.
Well, I think when I was actually arranging my thoughts and thinking this through, and I probably should have said it, there's a caveat. You can't make people be transparent. You can't make people be trustworthy. You have no control over their thinking, their motives, or if they're not transparent, the only thing that I can do is say, I don't feel that you're being upfront with me and that you're honest about this, if you even want to say that. And I think I'll touch on that a little as we get to boundaries, because there's a difference between a boundary and a threat, although sometimes we call them the same thing. Well, let's move on to communication. I told you I had a lot of stuff. I had great fun going through our literature and thinking myself and putting down things. But the second one, besides trust, that helps build intimacy is good communication. And it's quite shocking to know that communication is really not about talking. It's really more about listening. Listening for understanding. I learned that communication does come from a Latin word meaning simply to share. I like that, to share. I mean, how much communication is one way? You know, you listen. I have a friend that calls me from Maine, and I get in about 5 words, and we've been on the phone an hour. I don't really call that communication. I call that exhaustion. So it's to be in relation with somebody, a two-way, and no mind reading. You know, I was so guilty of thinking that somebody should know what I was thinking. Why would I have to say that? You know I don't like to go to that restaurant. Well, not necessarily. You know, somebody doesn't know that. I hate their pizza. Well, why don't I say that if I hate it? We won't go there. It's very simple. And clear and kind is a condition of communication. I was thinking that a dictator can be clear, but a dictator is not kind, necessarily. And there's a lot of dictating that can go on. Lots of barriers to communication. Some of them for me were my lack of courage to speak up. I was fear of judgment. You heard last night, Cliff said he just went along with the guy in the restroom. That doesn't sound good, does it? Because he was afraid of what the guy would think, but I'm so guilty of that. Or rejection, or being ridiculed, degraded, or simply ignored, or suspicious. You know, somebody's speaking, you don't trust them right away. It goes on and on. Or if you're the person who always needs to be right, you don't want to say you're sorry. And for me, I have learned this in recovery. My husband is pointed this out to me gently and kindly. But he would say, you know, you're never very direct with anything. And I think that was kind of fear of what would happen. So I kind of go around the edges, you know, to get to it. And I remember probably the first time he said to me, do you want some ice cream? I said, I'll have a little. I get the bowl. There's like a couple tablespoons in there. I go, what's this? You know? He said, you said you wanted a little. I go, I want a bowl. You know? Well, why didn't you say that? Well, why didn't I? So now I say, I want a full scoop if I want ice cream. Just something simple like that. But he will check and say, is that enough? But that's all part of it. I think I just couldn't get straight on with some of my stuff. And then I noticed that I think I'd learned that from my mother. You know, I heard her doing that. So you see these patterns that you learn. It came from the past. Yep. So these are some questions I have for you, the four. Do you really acknowledge that communication is about much more than speaking? And with whom are you the most comfortable sharing your thoughts and feelings? When others are sharing at meetings, what are you doing? How does my meeting behavior compare to my interactions with my family? That one for me is very interesting because I'm very loving and tolerant and patient at a meeting. But it can be easy to come home and this doesn't happen at my house. I live with a great person. The dishes in the sink are in the dishwasher. But I know in the past I could come home and easily turn. I'm not the meeting person. I'm not the meeting person. In the chapter about sex and the alcoholic marriage, in the one, The Dilemma of the Alcoholic Marriage, there's quite a bit in there talking about, and this is from the Al-Anon attitudes, it talked about five attitudes that come to light among Al-Anon members. And this is regarding sex as an intimate form of communication. One attitude is the doubter, the person who withholds intimacy in relationship because not sure that sobriety is going to last. You know, it's going to keep going. So don't really want to trust, don't want to get too close. Another one is the dominator, refusing to respond, the control person. Being in charge, you know, not surrendering to an intimate moment. And then there's the punisher, withholding affection. I'm not going to bed with you. and the martyr. We have a, we have martyrs. I've been one. Refusing advances, you frigid, you know. You don't have any fun, you wet blanket. You know, I've been all of those. What's the last thing I can do? I can withhold me from you. Too bad, you're missing out, you know. I mean, that's not real intimate. And then there's the demander. I have a friend in Cedar Rapids, and we used to talk about, you know, the sex thing. And, well, this comes up with boundaries. But I had said, you know, I'm just not interested in sex with a drunk person. I mean, that became very clear to me when I was called the wrong name. You know, it's kind of discouraging. It's true. I know. I remember once him trying to lift up my long hair, but I didn't have long hair. But my friend Marlene said, I like sex. I'm fine if he's drunk or sober. And I said, good for you, you know. But one day she came to a meeting with a neck brace on. I never ask. I did look at it and she goes, don't ask. I go, I'm not asking. So, you know, different needs, different things. But she thought it was worth it. I did not. But in that book, there are five little tips for good communication. And I like these, and they're current today. One is discuss, don't attack. You know, discuss. That's very hard, the tone of voice, to keep it low, to keep it modulated, and not, you know, be rising in volume. Keep it low and pleasant. Stick to the subject. It's hard to stick to just one subject. I would build them all up and then let her rip. You know, I have your attention. Here they come. These are all my grievances. But it's just stick to the subject and listen to his complaints or her complaints. It's hard. And don't make demands. Simple. Discuss, don't attack. Keep it low and pleasant. Stick to the subject. Listen and don't make demands. I mean, you know, we're a basic fellowship here. And these are basic things, but they're critical to being heard, to being things being expressed. And then do you say what you mean and mean what you say? And then there's a third, and don't say it mean. Be honest. In our book, How Al-Anon Works, which is our equivalent to AA's big book, the Blue Book, this is a very excellent book, and there's a chapter on communication, which is excellent, about looking at patterns and not good patterns of communication. And as I looked over, there are two distinct categories. One is the quiet person who has trouble communicating. The other is the vocal person. And these are just a few things that are mentioned. Keeping quiet or agreeing to something to avoid conflict. So guilty of that, I was. I just let it go. Making promises and threats, but never carrying them out. Hesitating to speak because of the consequences. Those all describe me. I mean, in Al-Anon, I have found my voice, as you can tell. I have one. I know what I think and I feel. So I do identify with that quiet person. I let things happen. I just let them go. And my self-respect just kept going down the tubes. But then there's the vocal person, never hesitating to say what's on your mind, dispensing unwanted advice and criticism, being negative, delivering cold, stony silence. That's also a way of communicating or having a hidden agenda. So if you're interested in looking at some of those patterns and finding yourself in there, it's a very helpful chapter. But some of those tools, like I said earlier today, my first tool was learning to be courteous, putting down my weapons. I had a good weapon, my tongue. I could be really sarcastic, and we learned that it means to tear flesh, sarcasm. It's mean. It's not kind. And I think the best way to learn to communicate is by going to meetings. And our intimacy book says, paradoxically, meetings are for people who hate meetings, who don't like them. What have I learned in meetings? I've learned I only have a few minutes. I'm not the star of the show. I've learned if the topic is such that I should stick to the topic. I feel like talking about something else. You know, my dog ran away and my neighbor irritates me, but that's not the topic. Stick to the subject, don't dominate. And when I share thoughtful things about it. Don't ramble. Don't go on and on and on. I mean, I have a few friends that cover everything. If a newcomer's here, oh my God, they say, and welcome to the newcomer, and we've got, you know, this and that, and then I this, and the topic was acceptance. Totally forgot. And then if you have a group conscience in the meeting, this is wonderful to learn about communicating because everybody has a voice. Everybody can share, and it's consensus, and it's reasoning things out with somebody else. And even if the decision by the group is for the best unity for the group, it might not be what I like. And I don't have to have a temper tantrum and stomp away or give them the silent treatment. I go, that was the group conscience. I have learned tons about communicating in meetings. You know, looking at people, acknowledging, nodding, giving bodily feedback. And if somebody says something that's encouraging and principled, to go up to them afterwards and say, thank you for saying what you said. That was so good. I'm going to think about that this week. Because people did that for me. And I'm going, really? What did I say? But it's encouraging and it's helpful. And listening mostly without judgment. I think when I first came into the program, if I would hear people speak, I was looking at their socks, wondering what they did for a living, thinking about, boy, their hair is kind of funny. All those things that don't matter at all, you know. Listen for the message. Stop inspecting the messenger. I mean, I have learned that here. And it's really detachment with love. Because sometimes it's not easy to be loving and listening. And there was a comment, and I had to write it down, from a member who shared, God did not place me on earth to be wounded by others' happiness. So there's no need for me to stick around and enjoy inappropriate communication. And I thought, yeah, you know, I'm not going to talk anymore on the phone tonight. I'm tired. And that's detachment. Detachment with love is something else. I used to detach with contempt in the beginning, you know, and then detachment neutrally. And then eventually detachment with love. But not to stick around for those conversations that hurt, that aren't helpful, that don't build people up. And, of course, how do you work on communication besides going to meetings? Practice, practice, practice. And the traditions are great for that, for resolving serious conflict, especially tradition 2. That was so helpful to me. There is but one authority. A loving God who expresses himself in our group conscience. You're not the boss of me. That was helpful to me. Because I always thought that people knew more, were smarter, had the right whatever it was, and I went with it. But that's not true. It's not true for me. And I love concept 5 about the minority voice, the concepts of service, that the minority voice is protected and always heard. And I was the minority voice in my own life. So I really relate to that, that I have a right to share my voice, to speak what it is that's on my mind. So that's the second one, communication. And I knew there was a lot, so we're ticking down here on our time. But does anybody have a question or a comment about communication as path to greater intimacy? We have one from the Grapevine Man.
One of the things that I over-communicate, there was some stuff that happened when I was a kid, and nobody believed me, so there was that force to, no, I'm doing the right thing, I swear I'm telling the truth. And then I started drinking, and wasn't trustworthy, and, you know, coming to the program, and then the over-communication again. And so one of the things that I'm working on, still struggling with, is this woman at one of the meetings I go to up in Buford, Lisa Kay, and she says, you don't have to justify, argue, defend, or explain. No is no. You know, I'm not feeling well. It's just that I have to explain why I'm not feeling well, but I always feel the need, regularly feel the need, to do the jade. So I don't know, I guess, you know, what is your experience with the over-communicating part of communication?
Well, I would just say, Kevin, that I relate to it because I did it as well, and I think you explained it. You don't have to defend or explain. No is no. And usually people don't care. They're kind of happy for a short answer. I mean, I have asked people, how are you? And you go, oh, my God, I just heard about the trip to Arkansas. You know, I was wondering how he was. I didn't want to go to Arkansas. So keeping it simple is good. Anyone else?
Hey, I'm Rick Amendola. When you brought up this topic about trust, communication, and boundaries, I had been thinking about something that happened early on in my relationship. And, you know, I had been in a relationship where any time I said something that I might have gone differently, you don't love me, and if you love me, you would, and it was just horrible. So when I met Pam, and we've been together for a while, she liked to go to sleep with her head on my shoulder. And I loved laying there with her head on my shoulder. I really did. But there came a point where I wanted to roll over and go to sleep. And I couldn't. She would fall asleep with her head on my shoulder, and I didn't know what to do. So I talked to my sponsor at the time, and he said, do you trust her? And I said, yeah, I trust her with my whole heart and my life. He said, well, then tell her. Communicate that you would like to roll over and go to sleep. And so, you know, I built this thing up in my head that it was going to be this horrific scene, and she's going to say that I didn't love her, blah, 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 blah. And so one night I got up the courage, I said, you know, I'd like to roll over now and go to sleep. And she said, okay. And so, yeah, so I set a boundary. It was great.
Yeah, I relate to that, and that's great to move into our last topic. And I love the topic of boundaries because I had none, and I have learned about them. And I think we know what boundaries are. It's just that do we have them? And a line in our book is quite unsettling to me. It says, unhealthy boundaries involve a disregard for your own and others' values, wants, needs, and limits. I mean, to disregard yourself is pretty serious. Like, I'm not that important. So they're limits, they're guides, and they're things that establish what's safe and what's permissible. And these are my questions for you. In what areas of your life do you have the most difficulty setting boundaries? Do you know what your boundaries are? And if somebody crosses your boundary, what then? And how do you respect the boundaries of others? And I'll just touch on this briefly. since our time is ticking by, but I think setting boundaries has saved me from a lot of heartache. But it's also helped me to identify what my standards and my values really are, and I've learned that in the program. It's given me an opportunity to look at what I'll tolerate and what I will not tolerate. And these are my truths, as we talk about in the program. And previously, I was so enmeshed in the alcoholic's life, I had no clue where I stopped or started. So boundaries have helped me reclaim me and establish who I am as a person without someone else. But the interesting thing that I also have learned is that learning about boundaries has helped me know where I have overstepped on yours. I really invaded the alcoholic's boundary. You know, my love was unsolicited advice. He didn't need that. He had his own higher power. Enabling, as has been mentioned, is crossing a boundary that's not mine to cross. I don't have to do for others what they can do. I am robbing them of the dignity of learning and growing. It's painful. I saw a woman in the airport when we were flying here, and she was all confused. She was trying to check in at the kiosk, and she had to call the attendant over, and she said, "I don't know what my confirmation number is." And I know right where to find it. And I was so tempted, you know, to go over and say, "If you pull up your old email, it's on the top of the notice from American." It was right here. And I thought, you know what? She needs to have a little stressful lesson about this. And it's her deal. And I just turned and we walked up to board. But things like that all the time. You don't have to help people. She didn't ask me. She didn't look out and say, "Oh, Judy Kirby knows what, you know." She was not interested, but it was her deal. But I have crossed over other people's boundaries. And I mentioned the difference between a threat and a boundary. I used to say, "If you drink again," with the finger. That's not a boundary. I thought it was initially. But it's really a threat. Because a boundary that's spoken out loud as a public announcement is usually not a boundary. It's a threat. But a boundary is a private personal conviction, which I learned. If he drinks again, what will I do? What am I willing to live with? What am I willing not to? And so, as another year came up and there was a promise that this year it's all going to be different, I didn't trust that. I hadn't seen evidence of that. We hadn't talked about that. And I thought, this may be the year that I do need to move on. It was not what I wanted to do, but the science told me the facts aren't revealing themselves. And do I want to keep banging on a door that's closed? Maybe I need to keep it closed and trust my higher power and move on. So a good thing with boundaries I have heard in the meeting rooms is what's yours, what's mine, and what's God's. And it's pretty clear if you ask yourself. If you stop and ask yourself, that's the thing. I heard somebody say, "God is in the pause." And I like that, because if I do pause, I have a better handle on how I should proceed. So everything with boundaries, trust, communication, it's all about spiritual solutions, because this is a spiritual problem, intimacy. And, you know, somebody said, "What is spiritual?" We have a little book about spiritual readings. I just wanted to read you the definition by this writer. I think it's beautiful. Everything is spiritual, which tends toward understanding, toward kindness, toward that which is productive of beauty and leads people on to a fuller expression of their divine potential. Each advance we make in personal insight and awareness of others is spiritual. So we've got it all right here. We have everything we need in our legacies, in our steps and traditions and concepts. We could be so spiritual we could float out of this room, you know, but that's not realistic. But we can practice because our program has endless tools. And two of the big solutions for me have been gratitude and service. And our book addresses that very clearly, you know. And I was thinking when I was flying here, I had been to Atlanta for the International, AA International Convention, because I was serving on the board at the time at the World Service Office. And the chair of the board said, we need a few trustees to go to Atlanta to work, you know, to be greeters and be at the room, etc. And we don't know how to pick them, but we're just going to put all the names in the hat and we'll draw out a few. My immediate prayer was, oh God, please do not draw my name because Atlanta has got to be awfully hot in July. That was my prayer. First name? Judy. Well, I still had a bad attitude, but I was on the plane to Atlanta, and we were about to land. It was late, and the pilot came on, and he said, the landing gear is not going down. Well, that caught my attention. I don't know what you do, but he kept circling around. And finally, he said, the co-pilot's going to crawl down under and crank it out by hand. Now, I don't know if that's true. I know nothing about being a pilot. But he said he's going to go down under and crank it out. Do you know I was so grateful on the ground to be coming to Atlanta that next morning I woke up. I am so happy to be of service. I can't wait to sweat and greet people. It all depends. But here I am back and we had no problems. So I'll just wrap it up with that. It's been great to be here and think about intimacy. And really, we're in a perfect spot. I don't think we're ever more intimate than we're in here sharing ourselves and who we really are. In the naked light of day, as one of my friends says, we are who we are. We're pretty flawed and imperfect, but I think we're wonderful. And if you have a chance to share with somebody this weekend and you haven't shared, you know, share something that you never shared before. It's kind of fun. I remember I sponsored a new person. I said, well, what's something you want to tell about yourself to me? You know, get us kind of started. And she said, well, I have an interest in other people's husbands. I go, well, that's kind of intimate. I wasn't prepared for that. But, you know, enjoy yourself. Talk to people and reason things out with someone else. And like we say in Al-Anon, let there be no gossip or criticism of one another. Instead, let the understanding, love, and peace of the program grow in you one day at a time. Thank you.